Accession number 32717, Reel 1.
223 missions over the hump. He's awarded a Distinguished Flying Cross, an Air Medal, and Purple Heart. And 223 times over the hump is quite a record. And here he is, hiding behind me, Bob Severson. Robert?
Ed, let me correct your statement before we go any further. I flew a total of 223 combat missions, but I flew two round trips over the hump. And I'll tell you about that as we go along. Some of you have heard me talk before, so I hope it isn't too boring, and I hope I get it right the second or third time. But I was asked to speak to this group, and I'm really pleased to be here and surprised that there are so many members, so many people in attendance. And that's great. And I still wonder if the silver stands for the color of the hair, or if still all of these folks are pilots. I grew up on a farm in northwest Wisconsin, dairy farm, so we had to be home milking cows by hand, night and day. And these barnstormers would come around with their biplanes and hop passengers. And I had my first ride with Ray Hagee. Some of you may know of him. He's deceased now, but he's known as the old prop maker down in Marfa, Texas. And he was flying a Waco 10 with a Milwaukee tank engine. And it was quite a thrill. The thing that I remember probably most about it was that after we were airborne and up in the air a little ways, it seemed like we were standing still. But it was a great ride. Always having had an interest in flying, during high school, a fellow by the name Elmer Rowe from down at Bloomer, Wisconsin, was an egg man. He'd come around to the farms and buy eggs and gather them together, and they were trucked to New York City. Well, he got himself a new tailor craft, and he came up to Dallas, and he was giving lessons, my younger brother and I. And I don't recall what we paid for them, but he was a pretty good flyer, and we could have a half hour now and then. And as I say, I don't know whether he had a private license, or if I know he didn't have an instructor's rating, but anyway, he was a good flyer, so we got a few hours in the tailor craft. After high school graduation, I went down to the Twin Cities, Minneapolis and St. Paul, and went to work in the plant that was doing defense work, but the type of work that I was doing was not critical. And it was getting close for the time to be eligible for the draft. During this time I was working there, I met my soon-to-become wife, and we were married on February the 14th of 42. Was that right, Norma? Anyway. I never lost my desire to fly. And up until this time, in order to get into the Aviation Cadet Program, you had to have 2 years of college, which I didn't have. But they lowered the requirements that would take fellows with a high school education. So I went down to Fort Snelling to enlist. And in the process, of course, they give you a medical exam. And part of that exam was to run in place. Of course, they'd taken your blood pressure first, run in place for 2 minutes, and then you sit down and they take it immediately, and then they take it 2 minutes later. Excuse me. Well, my blood pressure didn't come down after 2 minutes. And this major, I'll never forget, wrote on the application, permanently disqualified for all military flying. And so then I decided that I wasn't real keen on going into the infantry, so I enlisted in the glider pilot training program, which they sent us off. We were, I don't know exactly what our status was, we were not wearing uniforms, we didn't get paid. We went to a Worthington Junior College in southwest Minnesota, went to ground school for a half a day, went out to the airport and flew for a half a day, and then went to the armory for military instructions at night. Well, this lasted about 8 weeks, and I must say that the ground school was simply excellent. Since I had done some flying before, the owner of the school selected those with previous flying experience to be his students, so he didn't have to devote as much time to them. And we completed that program and was sent home and received orders to report to Hondo, Texas, the home of John N. Garner, John Nance Garner, Vice President under Roosevelt. Now, one of the first things that they did with us when we arrived there was to send us over to the hospital to take a physical exam, which was known as the 6-4, the same exam that I'd flunked in at Fort Snelling in Minneapolis. I passed it, and we were issued clothing and were marching around, and I got word that my dad had passed away. So I came home for the funeral and spent a few days. And when I returned to Hondo, the glider program was canceled. So having passed the 6-4 physical, one of the chances that you had was to go into aviation cadets, which is where I wanted to be in the first place. So I go over to San Antonio, Texas for pre-flight. And we had some very interesting experiences there in pre-flight, and I won't tell you about all of them, but the upperclassmen lived upstairs in a two-story barracks, and we happened to have the cadet wing commander in our barracks. And he was a very military guy. I mean, he looked nice. Had a Sam Brown belt and a saber, and he had hatch marks all over his arms, you know. And when he spoke to him, it was the same as speaking with a commissioned officer. Well, each evening they would have us in the aisle doing the upperclassmen were hazing us. And one of the things that they did when we first arrived from civilian life were kind of raunchy, and they'd ask, "Sir or Mister, can I touch you?" "Yes, sir." And they reached your belt, had the web belt. They tied it up about 4 inches and cut off the 4 inches, and there you were, like this. One of the others was to get you in a brace, which I can't do anymore, but it was something like this, you know. "How many wrinkles? I want to see more wrinkles in your chair, Mister." This was going on this one night, and across the hall was another fellow named McQueen, who was perhaps even worse than I was in laughing. And he would laugh, and then they would call a halt and get him out there, and the procedure was to wipe that smile off your face, mister, which was like this, just as hard as you could, and throw it down on the floor. Well, he soon had a whole squadron of smiles. And then he was ordered to march them up and down the base, which was kind of humorous, and for those who had a tendency to laugh, why, then we got into trouble, too. There was a man over in the far left corner, Bernard C. Powers. He was from Boston. He had kind of a high-pitched, squeaky voice. This evening we were being hazed, and I see out of the corner of my eye, someone is going over to Powers and telling him to do something. And about that time, the wing commander comes down from upstairs. And pretty soon I see Powers marching up to the sky. "Sir, Aviation Cadet Powers requests permission to ask a question." "What is your question, Mr. Powers?" sir, when are you going to cut out all this old shit and give us our wings? It had that same effect on the entire group. And so that made more easy. Well, we completed the 9 weeks there and went off to primary flying school. And I went to Fort Worth, Texas, where we would fly for half a day and go to ground school and PE every day, of course. We had the flying the PT-19s, which many of you know what they were like. They were a low-wing job with a steel tube fuselage and fabric plywood wings. Nice airplane, open cockpit. So you'd fly 1 week in the morning, and the next week you'd fly in the afternoon. But when you flew in the afternoon, you had your helmet on and your goggles. Well, then your forehead, at least mine did, and my nose and chin just sunburned, windburned terribly, and the next week it would peel. Well, this is the way it went on for 9 weeks. We had a donkey on the base that would drink Coke out of a Coke bottle, and I have pictures of it at home where this donkey was drinking this Coke out of this Coke bottle. It was one of the strange things that happened. From there, I went to Independence, Kansas for basic training, and when we arrived up there, as was the case when you go from one base to another, you were quarantined for 2 weeks at least. You couldn't leave the base. And we're marching one day from the flight line back down to our barracks, and I look out to my corner of mine, here's my wife going into the enlisted men's PX. Well, I was dumbfounded. I couldn't go see her, but I knew she was in town. And she'd gotten a job on the base during this period of time that I was quarantined. Next, we went to completing that course, which was very, very interesting. The BT-13s had 450 horsepower Pratt & Whitney WASP engines, and we had to do a lot of preliminary training, getting acquainted with the airplane before we could go fly. Now, in primary, we didn't have radios in the airplane, and they had what they called a Gosport tube. And the instructor, it was more like a funnel and a tube that went up to the helmet and into each ear of the student in the front seat. Well, the BT-13 had a similar tube down here, and as we had to learn where every instrument was and where the controls and flaps were, and I'd look over at a couple of guys and they're talking in what they thought was a Gosport tube, but it's not for another girl. We started formation flying in basic. And this was really interesting because the instructor took two student pilots, and he was in the lead airplane, we were on his wing. And we're flying around, and he would give signals when he was going to change the pitch or so on, and we were to maintain our position in regard to his airplane. And pretty soon we're out there, and he gives a signal to put down the flaps and to change the pitch of the propeller, and we're still flying in formation, and pretty soon our wheels are rolling on the ground. We had no idea where we were, but that was part of the training. Had night flying, and this was an interesting experience because at night your depth perception is off a little bit, and your judgment is off in relative to the speed of the airplane. And what would usually happen, you come in and make a landing and turn off on a taxi strip when the tires are just squealing because you were going far too fast and didn't realize it. From there, went to advanced school in Ellington Field at Houston, Texas. Twin engine, PT 1819, built by Beechcraft, where they were all wood, had two 300 horse light booming engines on them. And we went out with the instructor, and we're doing slow flight. I'll never forget it. and he's asking me to make turns, flying slow flight. He reaches over and chops the throttle on one engine. Well, flying slow, we just went like this, and we're going down towards the earth. Well, we soon learned that if you lose an engine, you know, that situation, at kind of an airspeed, you have no choice but to cut the other engine as well if you want to control the airplane. Single engine airspeed became very, very important to us. One of the things that we had to do at Ellington was to get, I believe it was 5.5 hours of night cross country. So what you do, you team up with another pilot, student pilot, to ride in the right seat, then you flew on the left seat and would go out and try to get these hours in for this night cross country. We flew a triangular course from Houston, I don't remember, I think one of the towns was Nacogdoches, and another one, I don't recall, but it was a triangular course. And we'd have to check in at each of those corridors, and then we were supposed to come back and check in over the airport at our home base. And I said to Paul T. Shy was my co-pilot, I said, you know, I think if we slow and fly this thing, we could probably get this 5.5 hours in tonight. So we didn't check in. We just circled around the field. And pretty soon, it was getting close while we checked in. And they said, sorry, you can't land here. We're fogged in. We said, what do you mean you're fogged in? We can see the runway lights. We were looking down at it from above. So they sent us over to the municipal airport. And, of course, they had fog, too. But we landed, went through the fog, landed, taxi back. The next day, they sent a qualified pilot, a lieutenant, came over to fly the airplane back. And he said there was so little air gas in the tanks that he wouldn't even taxi it. So we were lucky, but we got the 5.5 hours in. Following graduation, I should say this was quite an event for graduation because here we got our silver wings and the gold bars of a second lieutenant. And we had a choice then of where we wanted to go, and of course I wanted to fly a C-47. I wasn't too interested in bombers, and I was having been through a twin-engine school, the fighters were out. I was too large anyway for them. So we were sent to Austin, Texas for troop carrier training in the C-47s. And here we flew with an instructor, until we'd got enough experience, we could check out, and we would fly formation, and we learned to tow gliders. And this was quite an experience, because the C-47 doesn't fly nearly as well with a glider tied on behind it as it does without. So we would take off in a single tow, and the procedure was, the glider pilot was to become airborne long before we did, go up 25-30 feet and then put nose down and get a little slack in the rope so we could get the C-47 off. Well, that was quite an experience. And then part of that training was that we had to go back and fly in the glider with the glider pilot because they warned us again and again that if we ever flew them faster than 110 miles an hour, they could court-martial us. So we got in the glider, and we're flying, and this was that Waco CG-4A that would carry a Jeep and about 15 soldiers. Great big plexiglass nose on it, made in sections. And when they drove the Jeep in, you lift the nose of it up and drive the Jeep in, but the men would come in. We were not loaded, of course. But as we took off and did, as I said, we got airborne right away and then give the tow plane a little slack. pretty soon he gets off, and we go up climbing around slow like this and gaining altitude. And then when the glider pilot decided we were high enough and in the right position, he reached up, had a great big T-handle up here, and he pulled that down and released the rope. And it went just like this, you know, all the way up, snapped up to the tow plane. Then he pulled the nose up, and it got very quiet, very quiet in that thing. We circled the field all the time, letting down, and then made the approach on the base leg, and as he was, he could see that he was high, and he was supposed to be high, he reached down and pulled up a great big bar, or pipe, about 5 feet long, and that raised spoilers, on the metal spoilers on the top side of the wing, and destroyed the lift, and the glider would just settle like so. He let it up on it, and of course we made it, you know, a perfect landing. Well, we towed, then we towed gliders double tow. And in a C-47, a double tow of CG-4A gliders is almost impossible to get it in the air. I mean, you run a long time. And then we flew double tow formation. Well, the lead ship would go out probably 60 miles. And he'd make a very slow, gradual turn, coming back, and we could see him off here in the distance. And our program was, our training was, to start your turn soon enough so you could enjoy this formation and be in the right spot. Well, that was quite a feat, because you didn't have much leeway on your speed with two gliders behind you. But that was part of our training. We flew for 2 months, as I recall, as what you might call student pilots, and then we were, had others assigned to us as a crew, and we flew together as a crew for 3 months. So we were there in Austin, Texas for 5 months. I had a co-pilot whose name was Andrew Baumert from Arizona, Phoenix, Arizona. My crew chief was Gerald Parker from Maryland, and the radio operator was Howard Campbell from Portland, Oregon. Howard was a graduate of Columbia Law School. I don't remember about Bomber's education, but anyway, we flew together then for 3 months. And upon completion of the training, we sent home for a brief rest leave, and then we were to report to Fort Wayne, Indiana. And when we arrived at Fort Wayne, we checked in and we were given a lot of briefing about what to do if you were captured. We got a crew cut, and then was issued one new C-47 airplane, two Pratt & Whitney engines, two Hamilton Standard propellers, and 24 Army blankets, and I had to sign for it. Well, we get out to our airplane, and here is a brand spanking new airplane, fresh from the factory. You know, the DC-3 had cushioned seats for the pilots, and they had cushioned armrests where they would swing out like this, make it easy to get into the cockpit. The floor up in the front cockpit was carpeted, nice green carpeting, and this airplane smelled just like a new car in a showroom, is what it was like. So here I am, 22 years old, I've got a brand spanking new airplane, and we're getting ready to go overseas. Let me see if I can show you on the overhead. That doesn't work right, does it? How's that? Sorry. Thank you very much.
Good way to get sympathy, Bob.
Pardon me?
Good way to get sympathy.
Yeah, and assistance, too.
On the post, right there. There you go.
How's that?
That's perfect.
A little better?
Perfect.
So here we are.
Oh, that's all right.
At Fort Wayne, picking up this new airplane. And I should add that we were assigned a trained celestial navigator at this point, who would ride with us wherever we were going. So here's Fort Wayne. And we, all we knew when we left here was that we were going to Bangor, Maine. And when we got to Bangor, it was Dow Field, I think it was called, the runway came almost up to the river's edge. It created maybe a mental hazard, but beyond that, nothing. We were there a day or so, and the orders were cut, and they were secret. We could not open them until we had taken off for our next stop, which was Gander, Newfoundland, up here. My wife and I had worked out a code system because all of your mail was censored, but we knew someone in each theater of operation at this time and around the world. And so I told her that I had just run into Adolf Berg, a high school classmate, and that meant to her that I was going to India. So we flew from here to Gander, Newfoundland. Now, this had good weather and everything. We get up there, and we're landing on a runway that's 1,000 feet wide, and they have airplanes parked on both sides of it, waiting to go overseas. It was fabulous to see. I should point out that the C-47 has four gasoline tanks, two on each wing. One of them would hold 202 gallons, one would hold 200 gallons, and yet two more. So altogether, we could carry 804 gallons of gasoline. But what they had done for this over-the-water trip, they put in four temporary tanks. And they were made out of what to me looked like a creosote material, like you put on a building for insulation. And we didn't put any gasoline in them at this point. We flew to Newfoundland, as I say, and we were there for, I believe it was 7 days, and the weather had cleared so that it was planned for us to travel, to leave. Well, we were about fourth in line, and before we taxied out, they'd filled these auxiliary tanks. We taxied out with about four or five airplanes ahead of us, and a Canadian B-25 crashed and burned on takeoff. It was out there burning off the end of the runway. They canceled the rest of the flights, and we taxied back to the flight line. Now, here we have our wing tanks are full, and these temporary tanks are full, and they're leaking. The fumes are horrendous in there. We waited another 5 days for the weather to clear, and then we were scheduled to leave. And they always had us leaving at about midnight because our next destination was the Azores Islands. Well, we get out to the airplane and fire it up, and through my mishandling of the throttle and the mixture control, it backfired badly, flames shooting out the front of that and just loaded with fumes in the back in the cabin. But fortunately, I kept the starter going and pulled the flame back in, got them fired up, and we took off without mishap, climbed up to, I'm going to say, probably 10,000 feet, maybe a little more. After we were at altitude, we would switch to the auxiliary tanks, and that was a standard procedure. Now, there were at each valve, the tanks for your gasoline fuel valves, there were two positions for the two wing tanks, and we wanted to draw out of these temporary tanks and put in the off position. They warned us and cautioned us to be sure and never run those temporary tanks dry because it was possible to get a vapor lock and engines would quit, you wouldn't get them started again. We arrived at Azores in, I'm going to say, probably 10 in the morning, 10:30. First experience landing on a metal landing strip, you know, where they made this strip. It was just dirt with these metal slats joined together. Noisy as all get out, but it was made a good landing strip. We stayed there a day or so, and then we took off from there for Marrakech in French Morocco. Now, in our training in the States, in our instrument training, we had never done any actual flying on instruments. We had the cardboard shield, or plywood shield up there, and the safety pilot, and we had special glasses, not like you have today, but anyway, that was our training for instrument flying. As we're approaching Marrakech, we could hear the radio that they had inclement weather, and they had airplanes stacked up to over 20,000 feet.